Hello, people. Welcome to the When in Yorkshire podcast. I hope you're all very, very well. This is episode 63, and this is another episode that has been rescued from the digital abyss where it was being held captive for over 12 months. And I'm really, really excited to release this one. This episode features guitarist Will McGonagall of Symposium and Hell is for Heroes. Now, before I get into this episode, I will shout out that Hell is for Heroes are about to go on tour. They will be hitting the Bristol Fleece on the 3rd of April, Glasgow Garage on the 4th. I don't know who planned that route, but that's a big journey. Manchester Academy on the 5th of April, and then London Electric Ballroom on the 6th. There are limited tickets left for most of those dates, as far as I'm aware. So, yeah, get on your internets and buy them. As a bonus treat, previous guest Tom Campbell will be working his light-based magic and making them look awesome too. So get along to those gigs. So all of the guests pretty much that I have on here are people that I have personally selected. Every now and then I do get asked to speak to individual people, and if I then listen to them and find them interesting, then I will agree to do that. But most of them I've selected because they're people that I'm interested in speaking to. And every now and then, I'm lucky enough to spend some time with someone whose work has had a significant impact on me. And this is absolutely one of those times. Now, I enjoyed Symposium when they were first around, and I've certainly developed a much greater appreciation for what a force they were, especially live. But Hell is for Heroes had a huge influence on me as a musician, and they were and still are one of my favourite bands to see live. Now, I'm pleased to report that based on spending an hour with him, Will is a freaking delightful person, and I would definitely go for a curry with him. The list of gigs that he was telling me about and that he attended back in the kind of early to mid 90s is absolutely amazing, and it was great to hear his experiences with, you know, record labels and all sorts going back into the early days of Hell is for Heroes. In fact, I'm going to stop and just let you listen to the conversation. It's taken long enough to get this one out there. This is episode 63 with the delightful Will McGonagall. So I'm here with Will McGonagall from Hell is for Heroes and Symposium. First of all, have I pronounced your name right?
Yeah, you have.
Awesome. So how are you?
Really good. It's the first night of a tour with Hell is for Heroes. It's our first set of shows in about 5 years. So yeah, we're, you know, it's quite exciting.
Absolutely.
Nice to hang out with the boys. All good.
Excellent. Excellent. Good to hear. So yeah, how's have you done any kind of warm-ups prior to coming here? I didn't see anything on
the
social media.
No, we've kind of been rehearsing kind of like once a week for quite a long time. That's what we do. We kind of like take ages, and we start by rehearsing in pretty grotty, cheap places. And our thinking is, well, obviously it's cheaper, but like I think it is, if we can make it sound good in there, by the time we roll out into the big room with all of our kit and all of that stuff, then it should all just come together quite nicely. So that's what we've been doing, and then we've kind of upped it. And then finally yesterday we had like a full rehearsal with all our backline, and it sounded good. We're happy with it.
Nice. I've seen you've got that Victory have stocked you up with some
lovely
amps.
Yeah. We've kind of... yeah, we're starting to use those. They've lent us a load of like super cool cabinets as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, we look like a proper rock band, which is all we've ever wanted to do.
I mean, I'm assuming they sound great, but
they do
look beautiful. So.
Yeah, they sound great, which is the most important thing to us. You know, it's a big rock sound. We're kind of uncomplicated in that way. But, you know, I think loads of bands are guilty of overcomplicating it, really. So yeah, we're really happy with the sounds we've got.
Amazing. Yeah, I've seen that you previously have enjoyed the mezza sound.
I have.
How does it feel to kind of venture away?
I mean, you know, it's kind of, I'm at home, I've got lots of different amps, you know, not just mezza. I have used mezza for most of my time playing. But yeah, it just felt like it's been like 5 years, and we're just trying to do a couple of new things because you know, to be honest, we've got less riding on, like, we're not a career band or anything, you know. We kind of do this because we love each other and want to hang out, and the easiest way to do that is to kind of get some gigs in the diary and have a reason to, you know, to rehearse and kind of have a beer afterwards and stuff like that and kind of just hang out. So, like, now it's just like, yeah, what kind of fun stuff can we do? And, like, you know, playing with new amps and kind of trying new sounds and even writing new songs is what we've been doing. You know, it's kind of amazing. a nice thing to be able to be allowed to do, really, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, amazing. Yeah, so first of all, it's awesome that you guys are back around for however long that may be.
Yeah.
It's amazing that there's new music out there. That's been an absolute treat.
Thanks.
But yeah, I want to kind of start at the way back.
Yeah.
So, I get a question I ask everybody is, what's your first, earliest memory of music?
I mean, it's just going to have been the stuff that my parents were playing, or my big sister. Mm-hmm. My mum and dad are Irish. So there was a lot of Irish music. There was also a lot of country and western from their side of things.
Okay.
So I probably got into things like Johnny Cash at kind of like a weirdly early age.
Yeah.
You know,
it's just dark.
Kinda, it sticks with you. I mean, like, yeah, but it was cool stories. You know, he's like a storyteller, so they really did resonate. So if we were in the car on our way to a relative's or something, that would kind of be what was on. And then my sister is like 5 or 6 years older than me, and she was kind of a bit of an indie kid. Mm-hmm. So kind of inherited my love of bands like Ride from her.
Yeah.
Like, but also she was like really into U2 and stuff like that. And I really kind of was into it as well. Like, you know, whenever the Joshua Tree came out, I was like 8 or 9, I think. And it was just like, it was like, yeah, this is pretty good.
Still stands up.
It really does. Like, me and my wife went to Rome to see them at the Olympic Stadium do that tour.
That's not bad. Nice.
A little kind of weekend away a few years ago, and it was wicked. Like, you know, and like the Italian crowd were just incredible as well. Like,
it's so pretty universal, you two, isn't it? Across the world, people either really love them and go mental as a group, or kind of not fussed
actually think the hatred of them is kind of a shtick. You know, I don't get it. Why do you hate them so strongly?
For what they, you know, it's that thing of, but what did you two ever do for music? It's like, well, there's a lot of things that actually you could trace back to you two.
For sure.
Certainly those early albums and in punk as well.
Yeah. So that tour, sorry to kind of, you know, digress. That tour, they came out and kind of played pre-Joshua Tree stuff on a little stage in the centre of the crowd.
Oh, wow.
And it was like raw, and it was rocking, and like, it was big, and they were kind of, it sounded as in your face and punk as some of the most kind of, you know, in your face punk shows that I've probably been to in like 300 capacity venues. They just managed to do it, to get a really raw, great sound in a stadium. And then obviously the polish and like massiveness of Joshua Tree afterwards.
Amazing. That sounds wicked. Awesome. I was gutted not to, I remember what they sold out so quick.
Yeah.
My dad's a huge U2 fan, and so he was just like, yeah, we'll go to Dublin.
Yeah.
And, you know, we'll go see them there. And I was just like, well, it's, you know, 3 minutes past 9 and it's sold out, so maybe we won't.
Yeah.
But yeah, that sounds amazing in Rome as well.
It was wicked.
good, yeah. Nice grounding there of U2 and Johnny Cash.
Got lucky. It could have been worse, right?
Absolutely. So in terms of, I guess, your own discovery then of music, where did your path take you, and what's the kind of the first thing you remember buying?
Everyone kind of buys embarrassing kind of singles whenever they're kids as well, but I don't I'm not embarrassed by the first album that I bought, I think, was actually by Pet Shop Boys.
Okay.
Still,
but again,
still a good record.
There's a lot of stuff that they gave to the world.
Yeah,
absolutely.
You know, but there were like also, you know, other bits. I think I bought A-ha's first album.
Okay,
it's got.
So you're liking the melody then?
I'm sure. Yeah, that's it. And, you know, kind of like my kids, they're just drawn to like big hooks. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's kind of, you can fight it if you want, and but you know, sometimes you just can't deny it.
Yeah. Well. Two things on that. So my daughter schools me in the way of anything kind of Ariana Grande and that side of pop, and she's in many ways, she's managed to point out, she's 10, and she's managed to point out a lot of stuff where I would go, yeah, it's just disposable trash, and she's like, no, listen to this.
It's like, okay,
that is actually quite clever. Maybe I haven't given some of these things a chance. And then my son, who's 5, he kind of follows her and her music. However, he's a massive fan of Night Vision. And I don't know why that particular song sticks to him. But it's, over the past probably couple of months, it's kind of been on a rotation.
Yeah.
And whenever it comes on in the car, that one in particular, he was just like, "We put that on again, please." Like, he's very polite.
That's but, very cool.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not sure why, but there you go. There's a foray into there's the younger generation.
Yeah, a little hook in there somewhere. That sounds good.
Absolutely. So developing from there, live music. What kind of took your?
Yeah. So then, like, you know, there comes an age where you start getting into the music that's probably going to be part of your life for the rest of your life, and like it was around the time when things like MTV were playing videos of bands rather than kind of shows of, you know, like programs or whatever. So there was like loads of kind of grunge stuff on all the time, but then they also had like alternative shows. Like, I think they had something called 120 Minutes, where you kind of like learn about bands you hadn't really heard of, and then also just Bigger Brothers and, you know, of friends at school were like passing down cassettes of stuff like Bad Religion and No Effects and things like that. But I think like I've got into the Smashing Pumpkins in a big way. My first ever show that I went to see was Rage Against the Machine at the Yulu.
Oh, wow.
Which was a monster. It was just around the time of the first album coming out.
That must have been intense.
It was massive. And we, you know, me and my mates who went, we were tiny. So, you know, like we were like 13 or something. We were like so happy to get in there and so happy to be able to get served. And then went down the front and it was just like absolutely nuts.
Life-changing.
And then from then on, just went to like gigs of any size, really. So all the big bands, like back in the day, a big band would play Brixton. That was as big as it gets. Now, obviously, like alternative things go to arenas and sometimes stadiums. So things like Pearl Jam or Smashing Pumpkins or Nirvana had dates announced, Soundgarden and stuff. They were all doing Brixton. So we'd go to all those kind of things. But we'd also go to a venue in London called The Garage, which seemed to get all the kind of Lookout and Epitaph bands coming through. So like Green Day played there, Offspring played The Garage when Smash came out. No Effects, whenever like White Trash, you know. So we were just going to all those gigs. And
There's some landmark gigs there.
But yeah, it was a brilliant time. And then all those bands, obviously, they kind of jumped up through the venues really quickly. So the next time you'd go and see Green Day, it would be at the Astoria. And then following that, Brixton, and following that, whatever. And, you know, it's wicked.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. You've just listed off a whole load of bucket lists for me of people to see. And seeing them in and around. I'm guessing that's kind of, not sort of like 96, 97, 98, around there.
That's right. Maybe between 94 and 97, I think.
Yeah, wow. What a time it was. Just list the stuff that you've listed there. Like you say, it's stuff that sticks with you forever.
Well, it's funny that a lot of those bands have stuck about as well, because if they hadn't, they would just that would have sounded really boring.
Yeah.
Who? But, what are you on about?
Yeah. No, but those are bands that other people I've spoken to for the podcast that they've kind of cited as when that album came out, but I think you're the first person that's kind of listed off a load and has been to seen them around that time.
We were lucky, but me and my mates, we were like obsessed with going to shows. That's, you know, we all got like Saturday jobs and spent all of our money on going to gigs and then like saving up for guitars and things like that. Do you know what I mean? Because you'd go and you'd kind of go for a bit of a mosh or whatever, and you'd be like, wouldn't it be wicked if you could do that? And people kind of mosh to your music, and that was kind of what we did.
Absolutely.
That was the motivation.
So when did you start playing?
Probably around the same time, really. We kind of picked up, I picked up like a guitar really cheaply, kind of just started playing along in my bedroom, just kind of taught myself. Like, you obviously learn a few chords out of a book, but then I just remember like putting on records and trying to play them from beginning to end, and just again and again, you know, and you're just standing there just trying to play along. And I think in terms of like guitar playing, like I kind of really hooked on to Siamese Dream by Smashing Pumpkins. Like, you know, I really loved the guitar sound, and just you know, it felt massive at the time.
Still does. Siamese Dream still stands, just in terms of its recording. I think it sounds great.
It's a really kind of beautifully produced kind of record. Just kind of would play along to that. And then obviously, like, the you're probably not playing it right, but there's shapes that you kind of make with your hands and stuff.
Yeah.
That's just maybe how you hold a guitar from then on. Do you know what I mean? It might not be the right way, but it's your way. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. I remember playing, I've probably been playing a couple of years. And then I went and started playing with some other people, and they were just like, "You're playing D wrong." It's just like, my fingers were in the wrong way.
Yeah.
I was like, still playing the right notes. So just like, technically, it was the wrong way around.
Yeah.
It wasn't until you start kind of looking at efficient ways to get around a fretboard that you go, yeah, maybe I should change.
It's true. Like my boy is kind of interested in playing guitar, and I just feel like I can't really teach him because I'll teach him wrong stuff. Do you know what I mean? So I think we're going to do one of those online apps where they tell you, and I was like, we'll just do the lessons together. So I'll learn how to play guitar properly.
That would be amazing.
Yeah. That's how you play an A. Wicked.
Yeah. So in terms of you actually kind of forming a band then, is that just kind of naturally through playing and then finding other people?
Yeah, it's mates at school, and of which, most of them are in Hell Is For Heroes as well, but Symposium as well. Like we all went to the same school.
Mm-hmm.
Me and Joe, who are in Hell Is For Heroes, were also in Symposium. And like Ross was like, I was in loads of the same classes with Ross, who's one of my best mates. And Haggot was in the same year. He was like a very kind of cool kind of guitar player. He had like excellent taste in music. Boytek was a couple of years older, was writing songs. But we were just talking about music every break time. We would kind of go to this, what shows we were gonna go and see. And then it became, let's kind of go and rehearse some stuff. We'd go and play covers in a youth club. It was like 20p to get in. It was called The Last Chance, which we didn't really kind of read much into. But yeah, we kind of, that's what we'd done on a Friday. And then, we'd try and get some cans from an offie and kind of like just talk about how fun it was. Do you know what I mean?
What can you remember your first covers? What were they?
Yeah, I think probably the thing we used to keep on coming back to is probably Bro Him by Pennywise. Oh. That was quite a funny one. Because like we'd set up crash mats and because it was like
stage diving.
So yeah, that was it. Yeah. We practiced that more than playing, and then just the kind of sing. Like,
yeah.
That was just us, and then we'd like run out of kind of like steam, and then somebody just start playing
start
the bass line again.
Yeah, let's
do it. So it was stuff like that.
Did exactly the same thing up here. We used to. I've said this so many times on the podcast that basically the school that we went to when we were about sort of 14. They had a PA just in the music room, and we kind of took it in turns to go, and there was a pub in one of the little estates that had a pool room, and they just let us push the tables to the side, and the rules were basically if you're sick you clean it up, and if the police come just slide your drinks to the side, and we'd just get somebody's parents to drive up to school, load the PA into somebody's boot and then drive it. So we just had everything going through this, 500 watt PV. With like 8 channels.
Oh, man.
Stick the kick drum through it. Stick 4 vocals. Right, should we mic up the guitars? No, just turn them up loud.
Yeah.
It's fine.
Yeah, and that's exactly the same.
And smashed out Bro Him for about 45 minutes. It was,
yeah. Yeah, that was it. We could play like 30 second stints of tunes more than like complete ones.
Yeah, absolutely. It's absolutely amazing times, but it's good to hear that similar things were going on down south.
There's nothing too clever going on.
can you make the noise? It's like yes, and then play with passion.
Yeah.
Done.
It was a lot of fun.
So Symposium then. How did this come about? How did Symposium form and the trajectory?
As I said, like me, Joe, Ross and Haggop were kind of playing together. We had like a different bass player different times. We wanted to keep on being in a band. I think Wojtek was looking for a band. He was like a couple of years older than us, but still in the same school. But he'd written like songs and was kind of like handing out demo tapes at school. So we were kind of like heard these tunes and we were like, these are wicked. It'd be good. Like, you should come and play with us kind of thing. So that's what happened really. And all of a sudden we stopped kind of playing covers really and started playing the songs that Wojtek had written. And then we started kind of just getting gigs around what was like the toilet circuit of like Camden at the time. You know, we played all those boozers.
Bull and Gate. And
we played the Bull and Gate so many times. But then we kind of realised that we should probably just kind of do it less, and we started doing it like once a month.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, obviously you can kind of rope your mates in the less you do it, right? So we started doing that. But then the next time you know, because it hadn't gone badly, mates would have told their mates, and so maybe 3 or 4 months down the line off this new kind of tactic of not playing very much, there were like loads of people there who we didn't know. Do you know what I mean? Like, oh wow, this is kind of like different. And I think there were like, there were people, you know, people in the music industry, they kind of do find out about stuff, or they certainly did back in the day. You know, maybe the local promoter is like, I was expecting 30 people and 300 turned up. Yeah. That's nuts. Do you know what I mean? And they phone somebody who they know. So that started happening when like it just became carnage. And then, yeah, there was like a load of labels tried to sign the band. We turned down like mental amounts of money and tried to keep it cool.
We were offered
I think we were offered like £1 million by a label, and I've got to say I was up for that because that's quite a lot of money.
Back then as well.
I mean, you know, I
it is now, but
god, like, I was like, we should really put more thought into that. But no, we went with a, you know, we signed to Infectious, which was very cool as well. And but yeah, like there was, when that bidding war stuff was happening, I think we played at the 100 Club and it was like completely oversold. You know, you kind of go in there and you're just wet from sweat. Yeah. It's just, it was nuts. There were loads of like executives from like both sides of like the Atlantic, like so American labels, like really famous music industry moguls were at that gig, like passing out, you know, because of the heat and stuff. You know, the PA kind of cut out after like 2 or 3 tunes, I think, because of the heat.
It's dripping.
And so like actually it just worked in our favor. Everyone's like, whoa, there's something going on here. This, that's not normal. So it just kind of like jacked up the kind of intensity of people's interest, I suppose. And then got signed and kind of made
some
tune.
Some amazing shows as well.
Symposium were like a good live band. You know, we were tight, and the thing is, like, Wojtek wrote very hooky stuff, but because we were so kind of into like kind of angry punk records and stuff, we seemed to kind of like have that live. Certainly we had that energy and we had the sounds. It was like, I thought it was like way meatier. Like, it was really kind of like quite a tough sounding stuff whenever we really kind of got going live. You know, we were tight and we were hard and we kind of put a lot into it. So we did play some good shows for sure. Like, you know, look back on them and we were a good live band at times.
Absolutely. I never managed to catch you at all, which was a massive, massive shame. I was kind of hoping, it looked on the social medias, that there was going to be a bit more of a resurgence. I know there was some acoustic stuff and
Well, Symposium played a show in November. Like, we played a gig in London.
Was that the one at the brewery?
No. Oh, that was just a, like a chat. That was an that was an interview.
Right. Yes, yeah.
We played like a gig at Islington Assembly Halls.
Oh,
I think.
Wow. Okay.
It's like the town hall or something, and it was really good. Yeah, it's like, I don't know, like 900 capacity or something. It was like completely sold out. Everyone was like well into it. We had a good gig. Like, Ross was immense. You know, he's just an absolute beast. It just went really well. Like, we were all really kind of glad that we committed to doing it. You know,
well, hopefully somebody will convince you to do it again sometime. I'll be more on it.
People are asking us to kind of to do some more stuff, and we are talking about it, you know, see what happens.
Good. I won't get you to commit to anything.
No.
I have a tendency to try that, but I won't. I'll let it be and see what happens.
Cool.
So then so how did Hells come about from the kind of
Like, Symposium kind of split up, probably not on the best of terms, really. Like, it was, you know, it kind of didn't go right at the end. It went wrong.
Living in each other's pockets and...
Yeah, it's just a number of reasons, you know, and because, like, we are kind of... because we are in, like, touch and kind of rebuilding friendships and stuff, you know, there's no point in kind of, like, raking over it. And we were all, like... You know, that's like 19. Do you know what I mean?
So young, like, to kind of be thrown in at that.
But yeah, like, you certainly wouldn't hold any grudges this long or anything like that. So yeah, but we were unhappy with each other when the band ended. It's like it's how it went.
Yeah,
and then
very diplomatic.
Yeah, but then like, you know, I was kind of trying to write more stuff, anyways. You know, Symposium was always predominantly Wojtek's songs, and that's cool. But I was writing, and I kind of was into other stuff, you know. maybe the last symposium I was a bit schizophrenic and, you know, like super happy, kind of quite soft, oh, really angry and heavy. Do you know what I mean?
It's fun to listen to, though.
It
kind of works.
Yeah. Whenever the band finished, me and Joe decided we were going to do something else. Mm-hmm. And like Finn is one of our joint best mates and always kind of wished that he was on the road with Symposium, just from like a kind of, you know, like I love him. Do you know what I mean? I want him to be around and can like do that. I don't want to tell him about what we've done in the pub. I want to do it with him.
Yes.
Yeah. On the road. And so, yeah, he was up for coming and playing bass. And Tommy O'Donoghue was in our school as well. And he was up for coming and playing. So we were just the four of us. We would meet up on a Saturday. We'd do 3 hours of just like playing riffs that we'd kind of been coming up with. And then we'd go to the pub and kind of like, it was like a social thing.
Yeah.
And then we kind of decided that, you know, we should probably get a singer. We met Justin through a mutual friend who kind of put us in touch with him, and we went out with him and just kind of really got on house, like a house on fire. And then it's just, yeah, like I think, you know, we were out at 2 o'clock in the morning. He's like, do you want to be in our band? He's like, yeah.
Did he know that it was a kind of social interview?
Yeah, you know, I think he was looking for a band as well. Okay. Yeah. You know, it was a kind of a mutual thing, but we just got on so well. It's like, yeah, this is an absolute no brainer. And then we kind of went into the same rehearsal rooms and started kind of putting like melodies and kind of lyrics to the riffs, and it all just came together. Like some of the songs for the Neon Handshake came together really quickly, you know, and then we'd done some demos, people liked them, they convinced us to put one of them out as a single. It was like single of the week on loads of things, and then it was like boom, like we're in.
Absolutely. From the outside perspective, it kind of felt like that. Like I'd heard the name mentioned, and then I think I'd caught about the last 30 seconds of I think I Can Climb Mountains, and then all of a sudden I've just seen the name everywhere, and videos were constantly on rotation,
should be, right?
I know. I genuinely absolutely it was. And what are we on? 24 minutes in. Okay, so I've held it together pretty well so far, I think. So from my perspective, I'm just going to take over my own podcast. From my perspective, the Neon Handshake was massively influential to me as a somebody who was trying to start up another band, and I'd kind of been in various different bands and never quite kind of found the sound and feel that I'd kind of wanted. And then a couple of my friends I sort of said, oh, have you heard Hell Is For Heroes? They're like, fuck yeah.
Yeah.
And so we kind of just went, yeah, wouldn't it be great if we could play some just really, really great riffs with some really intense kind of vocals? And everyone was just like, yes, that would be great.
Yeah.
Not to just straight up rip you off, although we did cover a couple of your songs when we first started, just to
get on the
same page of just like, let's play something that we all have a mutual respect and love for, and then let's write some shit and see what happens and
take it from there.
So it was a massive, massive influence on that, along with, and it's just nuts, along with my vitriol as well, you know, and mostly for me, like some of their instrumental stuff that was on Fine Lines was some of my favourite bits of music of kind of that decade.
Yeah, it's really good.
Put those two together, it was a great time to be kind of trying to create something, just going, that sounds really fresh, it sounds really exciting, there's loads of energy, let's kind of take these sorts of feelings that we're getting from it and let's try and create something.
Yeah.
And did that for about 10 years with no success. So thanks for that. I hold you responsible.
I mean, we didn't have much success either. You know, we kind of sold you a bad vibe.
Well, you know what? Some of the absolute best years of my life playing all over the place. And yeah, absolutely love playing the Bull and Gate.
Yeah.
Sideways monitors. I remember those for a while. They were stupid idea, sounded amazing.
Yeah,
loved it.
Yeah, I think they're just like on chains or something.
Just like at ear level, perfect. on the side of the stage, and then live. I caught you guys at the Charlotte in Leicester, and that was one of the most intense gigs that I'd been to. I'll tell you this because it stuck in my memory for so many years. I just remember everybody was chatting, and then you guys kind of came on. I just remember this kind of purplish light just go down on Justin, and it went silent. I was like, fuck, this is going to kick off. And it absolutely did, and it was absolutely amazing.
Like, yeah, I remember the Charlotte just being hot.
Yes.
Anytime we played there, like, yeah. It was like you'd just been in, like, in a kind of hot shower or something by the end of the gig.
Yeah.
But they were wicked gigs.
It was, yeah, and that was amazing. There's a few other times that I caught you which were brilliant, but yeah, that one really stuck. And then finally, on my kind of gushing 4 minutes, I stood next to you whilst you played once in Leeds.
Cool.
You played, I can't even remember what it was called now, but it was there was no stage, so it was like in the basement of like a nightclub. There was no stage whatsoever, so you just kind of were playing on the floor at the same level as the crowd.
Right.
And for some reason, I kind of got squashed to the front and then realised I was just kind of stood next to you singing whilst you were playing.
Wow. Yeah, I'm trying to picture that. Like, I know we've done like a tour of really tiny gaffs where it was like that. It's just like places which probably didn't put on shows in a lot of cases.
I've never been to a gig there before or after.
Yeah, like we definitely kind of wanted to have an energy.
Yeah,
that's good. I'm glad that you know.
It was odd because I was just singing along and just having a great time and just looked over. You were about this far away, like about a meter and a half away. Just like, hello, good gig. So in terms of the Hell Is For Heroes trajectory as it kind of wound down, how did you find that? Because that must have been a strange.
Yeah,
time.
The whole ride is quite a, you know, it's quite a funny one, really. So, like, the Neon Handshake, we were so focused. Like, we kind of knew exactly what we wanted to do, and we had the means to do it. Like, we were allowed. We had, like, a couple of trial ones with different producers and stuff, like, recording one or two tracks. Mm-hmm. And we were just really kind of like, no, it's not right, it's not right. And we were signed to EMI, who were like, cool, what do you want to do then? You know, obviously we were building up like a bit of debt or whatever, but they kind of stuck with it. And we kept on saying, well, we want to try and work with these two chaps, Pelle Henriksen and Eskil Lovstrom, who had done some records that we liked, most famous of which would be The Shape of Punk to Come. Mm-hmm. We were like, instead of like playing The Shape of Punk to Come to kind of producers, whenever you're having those meetings, saying, well, what kind of records do you like the sound of? Instead of saying, well, we like the sound of this, why don't we go to them and say, we like the sound of this, but can you make us sound as kind of, you know, as kind of present? Because there were bits of that record where it was just dry and it felt really kind of like there, really close to you, but still had like the overall bigness of a rock record. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But the sounds weren't cheesy. Like, you can kind of go big, drench things in delay, and it just becomes a bit, you know, unfocused for the type of songs and music we were playing. We wanted like the big in your face sound, so we'd done it with Pelle and Eskil, and we went to Sound City in LA. Wow. We pretty much lived in LA for 6 or 7 months, kind of rehearsed there for ages and recorded. You know, that was all we done. We weren't with our mates or anything. We just made this record that we wanted to make, so that was brilliant, and it all kind of done as well as it done better than anyone expected, I think. And we started demoing for the second album, and I thought the demos were going pretty well. We'd written 30 songs or whatever.
Wow.
But there was like a bit of a change at EMI, and like the new kind of head guy was like, oh, can you just kind of like try and make it a bit more like, and he kept on like saying other bands. It was like, no. Do you know what I mean? It's like,
who were they? Well, do you remember any?
Yeah, I do. It's like, we were told it would be good if we could make stuff that sounded a bit more like, and that we looked a bit more like Lost Prophets.
Ouch.
You know, like, they were kind of, I mean, stylish people, I suppose. And
it's different.
We definitely went, but it was just like, this is like a rock band that's kind of like starting to kick off in America or whatever.
Yeah.
So, you know, a music industry dude is like, well, we would want you to do that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it was like, no, we've written these 30 tunes. We reckon we've got an album in here. And they were like, no, keep on demoing. And we said no. And then we offered to buy the tracks, that, mm-hmm. you know, because they'd spent money on recording some of them. we're like, can we buy these off you? And then you let us go. And they said, yeah. So we bought like 3 or 4 tunes, I think. And then the next day we got on the plane to Sweden and we done the record with Pelle and Eskil, and that was Transmit Disrupt.
Yeah.
But, like, and I kind of, I'm proud of it. But you know, there was just so much other stuff going on with the band that, you know, this personally, the same level of focus wasn't there. Like, you know, like it just felt more experimental. It's like, yeah, we can try. We experimented to a point, but it's like ultimately we know what we want each thing to sound like, because we just, you know, we were so on top of it. Whereas like we were just really open to trying things out on Transmit Disrupt, and it's good because it opened up our creativity quite a lot. But I also think whenever I listen back to it, there are like really good ideas that are sometimes drowned in like another good idea, or you know, and it for me it lacks some of the focus. Like there's some real highlights.
It's like making
there.
Decisions, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And we, you know, it was a triumph that we'd done it, and it was a triumph that we went out and toured it on our own kind of terms and things like that. But yeah, it definitely took a lot out of the band to kind of be more self-sufficient. It was like an amazing thing whenever Burning Heart picked it up, like a punk label who we really kind of admired. And that meant by default that Epitaph put it out in America and Australia and
that's,
stuff.
That's got to be a dream, like, just to, for that to happen. That's...
Yeah, so we've got like, you know, we've got like a record with that Tombstone E for Epitaph on there. Do you know what I mean? So that's a box ticked. And then we went into the third one, wanting to just be a bit nicer to each other and to enjoy it a bit more. Because, you know, we kind of, it was hard work at times.
Yeah, well, it becomes, it's a job.
Yeah.
So there is an element of pressure of kind of just sustaining.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So we just wanted to be, yeah, we wanted it to be more enjoyable. So we kind of, I'm not sure whether we ever said it, but we all made it clear to each other that this was going to be the last album that we were going to make.
Right.
And then we kind of rented a room, like a little studio in Shepherd's Bush for like a few months. And we would just go there and hang out and write and just be mates and stuff. And then we demoed stuff in there. And then, yeah, we very quickly got an album of stuff that we really liked, actually. The third album means quite a lot to us. And we're going to play songs from the third album on this tour. And I feel like they stand up quite nicely. Yeah, so then when we recorded it ourselves, which again was just like, it's about just having control and having a good time doing it. We're kind of happy enough with, you know, all of that. And then, so then whenever we've done the last set of shows around that album, we just felt like we left a kind of good looking kind of corpse kind of thing. Like, you know, we hadn't sullied the whole vibe of Hell is for Heroes. It hadn't kind of petered out in a really depressing way, you know. And so, yeah, we kind of, we left it nice. And then, and then we've kind of, you know, we've been come back a couple of times to do shows. Like, I think 5 years later, 100 Reasons for doing anniversary shows, 2012. And they really had to persuade us to kind of like do it, because we were like done. You know.
You finished
like,
that.
Yeah, we were kind of getting on with like real life, I suppose. But they did persuade us. And then we were like, okay, we're going to do it properly then. And we rehearsed loads. And I felt like we were good. You know, we played really well. And like loads of people who were there were saying, well, that was better than you were first time round. And we were like, yeah, you know, kind of believe you, because we put so much effort into it. You know, it felt really good. But then we just did nothing about it. It's like, we might do something about this, but no, we didn't. And then 5 years after that, we were approached to say, look, it's an anniversary of the Neon Handshake. Do you want to go and play it? And we were like, yeah, that sounds like fun now, because it's been 10 years since we were like a full-time band. Let's go and do 2 weeks of that. And again, we just rehearsed our socks off, and all the money that we knew was going to come in for the show, we spent on making the show really good, like, you know, on the kind of set and on the lights and on like just having like good people around us and things like that, and touring comfortably. So it's good fun. So we done it in a tour bus and we had hotels and we ate nice food and stuff, because it's not,
you went on a holiday with your friends and played some gigs.
That's it. It's more, it was more a holiday than like a career where you've got to like come home with like a chunk of money to, you know, it was a holiday from work. And we, it felt brilliant. And we were like, wow, we should kind of do something, because that was really good. And then we didn't for another 5 years. And so here we are.
So there's just two new tracks out, which are both great.
Thank you.
A lot of fun listening to. And not in the kind of, I found that that with the new tracks, and I don't know whether it's just my mental state, I'm not listening to Hell is for Heroes in any form of nostalgic state. It stands up
Thanks.
And yeah, it's been really refreshing over the last couple of months to kind of really get down, because I think probably I listen to tracks every couple of months anyway.
Yeah,
they just come up on rotation on different things. But yeah, to really kind of listen to all the albums, and then for there to be the kind of the treats of new tracks.
Yeah,
I think it does really stand out, and this is potentially where I sound old, but it sounds like musicians playing instruments.
Cool. Which, finally,
yeah. But there's a lot of stuff, and I don't know whether it's just because of the advances with recording technology and people getting their hands on stuff, but a lot of stuff sounds sterile. And
yeah, I agree.
Now I sound like, you know, my granddad when I moved from vinyls to CDs.
Yeah,
but
I know what you're saying.
I kind of appreciate it.
There is a load of rock where they've just kind of like got the same set of drum samples or whatever, and it's like that's a great kick drum sound, but it's the same as like everyone else's.
Yeah,
like there are so many kind of good records whenever you were kids. Can you imagine, you know, people who kind of grew up...
Queen.
Yeah, for sure.
Queen uses a sampled kit.
I was going to use a very... I was going to use an extremely different kind of example. Something like Minor Threat, where it basically sounds like a demo, right? Can you imagine if that was just Pro Tools to fuck and like everything was quantized and the kick drum was like the biggest kick drum you've ever... All of a sudden, it's just like quite meaty, generic hardcore. Yeah. Whatever, do you know what I mean? It's like... the energy of a young band kind of like just going through the motion, blasting it out in however little time they had. That was part of the sound as well.
Yeah.
I agree. Like, it's nice to hear real sounding records for sure. Larry from 100 Reasons produced these two tracks as well. Yeah. And we, you know, we just thought if we were going to do these gigs, we wanted to do something different. So yeah. New tunes being part of it.
Absolutely. And I was at, all of the kind of reunion, as it were, or celebration gigs in Manchester for all of them. So the one with 100 Reasons and then the anniversary.
Both good gigs, I thought.
Brilliant. Yeah, really good. And it kind of at that time, I think maybe the first one I was there and it felt nostalgic because I was just like, oh, I can't believe it's been this long since I... Because I was at uni when the songs were kind of really coming out and... and I was like, I can't believe it's been that long since I've been at uni, and having a bit of a crisis then. But then, then when you played your own anniversary show, it was absolutely brilliant.
We're proud of that tour.
Yeah, absolutely. So it sounded great, and I kept thinking, oh, maybe there'll be something new that comes along. So
yeah, because we talked about it straight after. It was, do you know, we should probably just write a couple of tunes because we all liked hanging out and stuff. Mm-hmm. You know.
Life gets in the way.
Yeah, that's exactly it. So we kind of we were sending demos of these tracks and a few others to each other because you can kind of just do things at home. But then then we got together and kind of started smashing out in a room and refining them and making them into songs. And they've turned out good. We like them.
Amazing. Well, thank you very much. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and I'm looking forward to the shows.
Wicked.
Enjoy them. Oh, one last question. Yeah. Sorry. So you've been going for beers and stuff. So what's everybody's favourite curry? I suppose curry featured quite heavily on the Instagram.
Yeah.
So.
Do you know what? I think we none of us can like stick to one, which I think is a strength.
Yeah.
Like, I'm a bit of a sharer, so if I went for a curry with you, for example, I would just let you order a bunch of stuff, and then judge you. He's got like three different types of korma. What's he playing at?
Oh God, no! I was having a chat with somebody for the podcast a few weeks ago, and they walked in and they were like, "Right, we're gonna order curry. What do you want?" It was like chicken korma. I was like, "He's not," and he didn't. What did he go for? He went for a tikka masala. So it was a step up from a korma.
And you know what? If there was a korma in front of me, I would absolutely demolish it.
Yeah.
I love it.
It's not a choice.
Yeah. So a bit of everything, really. A bit of everything.
Amazing. Well, when you're in Manchester on Saturday, there's some amazing curry houses in Manchester. So if you have the time, then I strongly recommend it. I know I'm kind of... It's the When in Yorkshire podcast, and I'm promoting across the other side of the roses, but it's true. I've got to give it to him.
Nice one.
Amazing. Well, yeah, have a great gig, and thank you very much.
Thank you. Cheers.
There it is. So what a guy. Will, if you're listening, I have my three selections picked and I am absolutely ready for that curry. Yeah, the gig was great. As I said in the intro, Hell is for Heroes are back out at the start of April, so get your tickets, go and enjoy a great show. There are still more episodes that have been rescued, which will be coming out very, very shortly, so look out for them. If you want to get reminded of when they come out, hit that subscribe alert or whatever it is that you do so that it pings up and tells you that a new one's out. And yeah, enjoy. Well, that's it from me. Thank you very much for listening. I'm going to let you... Well, yeah, that's it from me. I will leave you to the rest of your day. Thank you so much for listening and good night. Hey, thank you.